It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Listening is the key to understanding another story. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. We often do not hear the story of another, that narrative that makes up their lives. But this weekend, the stories of the lives of minority youth who often face the juvenile justice system in Waycomico County will be heard. It's a product of BARS, Stories of the System, A Youth Perspective, and the Phoenix Project. And these are their stories. At our studio this morning, we have Tim Stock. He's associate professor at Salisbury University, who helped establish the philosophy department's community impact internship. Also, Dr. Nelsita Walters-Jones. She is assistant professor who teaches criminal justice at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, focuses on juvenile justice. Also, Amber Green. She's with the Phoenix Youth Project. In our first segment, we're going to have two writers. Anastasia, we'll identify her as such. She's 19 years old, from Salisbury, graduated from Bennett High School. And also, we have Brooks Douglas. He is 28, born and raised in Salisbury, and is now a musician. In the second half, we'll have Taquise Douglas, Georgia, who's 16 years old, from Princess Anne, attends the Washington High School, as well as Andrew Carter Bay. He is 19, originally from, actually, Philadelphia. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, Amber, I want to start with you. And how did you, how did this project come about? And how did your organization's involvement?
Well, Phoenix Youth Project, we've always had a focus on youth who have had that contact with the juvenile justice system. It's just always been in the background of a lot of our work. And we were presented with the opportunity of partnering with Story Center, an organization based out of California who do story digital telling projects, to bring that power of digital storytelling to Salisbury on the Eastern Shore. And I knew that this was the perfect opportunity to bring light to an issue here in Salisbury, which is like juvenile crime. And that kind of like birthed the reason why Phoenix was brought here. The increase of juvenile crime in contrast to the decrease in overall crime in Salisbury was really our starting point.
What do you think that you're trying to convey with these stories to the public at large?
The main purpose for these stories is really to share a perspective and also to give light to different voices, especially to a conversation and a topic that is widely talked about a lot across the country. But you notice that there aren't youth voices, and those voices who have been kind of cast aside, they're not being brought to the table. So the goal for this project was really to empower those who are living, breathing, and in this mess, to give a perspective that has kind of been ignored for a long time.
So what was it like working with the young people?
Amazing. It was amazing. The one thing that I hold true to, the best thing about this project, was to really take honor how vulnerable the storytellers were able to get. That vulnerability was the first wall, the first barrier that we had to break down in order to get these stories to the level that they are now. And I think them, the storytellers, being so vulnerable, being so open, and being so trusting to the project, to the idea, to the vision, to the facilitators, that is why this project is going to be so impactful. It's going to go well beyond what we originally thought. And I really, truly think this project is going to be a lot deeper than what we thought it was going to get.
Well, finally with you, one of the things that really struck me about all of the pieces that I heard is there's a certain rawness to it, that there's a certain almost brutality in some instances. What do you think people will learn from that? I mean, do you think people will try to avoid that when they hear it, or do you think they'll be able to engage in it? What do you think? Because it's a real thing.
It is a real thing. Uh-huh. And I'm well known in the community of being putting people in situations and in perspectives for them to really truly understand, especially if they're going to have a conversation about youth, they have to have youth at the table. And if they're going to have a conversation about justice system or the juvenile justice system, you might as well have a conversation with those people who are involved, who have came in contact. And it's really important to be uncomfortable. You have to be uncomfortable to change. And I think this is going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. But that's what we need. The goal for these stories is can you go about your life differently after seeing these stories? That's the only question that I have for anybody. I'm not trying to change anybody's perspectives or anything. I just want to know, can you go about your life the same way after seeing these stories?
We've been speaking with Amber Green. She's with the Phoenix Youth Project, which produced this. Tim Stock, I want to turn to you because there's a certain philosophical underlying concept about what impact these stories actually have.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the question of what makes us uncomfortable is an important one, but part of what might make you uncomfortable in listening to these stories is just, in a sense, how normal and human they are. I mean, we tend to think about crime as being its own thing, but what really struck me in listening to these stories is how crime is about every other social issue. It's about, you know, having a job. It's about addiction. It's about getting angry and knowing what to do with that. It's about being in a tough situation and not knowing where to turn. So for me, the reason why people get uncomfortable is maybe because it asks them to think about the criminal justice system as being not something that's just out there, right, but something that's right next to our daily lives, something that could touch on any of us.
So what do you think, from a philosophical point of view, what do you think then the community then gains from this? And is the community outside of this, are they able to hear it? And what I don't mean by hear it, I don't mean like physically, but I mean internalize what they're hearing.
I think that's a good question. I mean, I can definitely say that nobody's going to hear it without these kind of projects. So I definitely am totally supportive of Amber's perspective when she says that the thing that you notice about discussions of crime is that you have an absence of voices of those people that have been affected by the system, and specifically youth. And that means that, you know, that's got to be the starting place, right? As to whether or not people are going to hear it, I think that it's important to acknowledge that everyone can only hear so much. You put the stories out there, people are going to take from it what they can. But at the same time, I think that you can expect a range of impact. Some people, I think, are really going to have their eyes opened. Some people might resist it or even get frustrated or might even retreat into some other story to describe that situation. But, I mean, you have to have the project in order to have that conversation.
I want to turn to Dr. Nelsita Walters-Jones. She is assistant professor that teaches criminal justice at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, focuses on juvenile justice. How do you see these stories that you've obviously heard reflect the kind of thing that you see in your work?
It is very important to sometimes move away from what we hear or, you know, what we see in the literature out there. Because I have been teaching this and I've been researching this. And sometimes what we see and what we hear is not really the true picture of what is happening with the youths. We have to move away from, you know, what is legal sometimes and look at the realities, you know, and that is the only way we're going to hear the realities from their perspective. What is it that they have to say? Because it's all well and good to hold them responsible for what they do, but it is also important to see it from their perspective. Just, you know, having them voice it, that is when we are able to see all the issues that they're facing. Nothing is in a vacuum. Sometimes we hear about the crimes that they commit or the behavior that, you know, cause them to come in contact with the system, but we never, ever hear about the issues, all the risk factors that are out there surrounding the reason why they are in the system.
Let me about that, because I was reading some statistics, and like in Maryland, for instance, in terms of juvenile justice system, minorities are like the overwhelming representative.
Yes. According to a report, a 2017 report, it is showing that 77% of juveniles who are committed in the system are minorities. And, you know, that is showing overrepresentation because that far exceeds their representation in the population.
We're going to write one other observation that I've had over the years, because I went through the 1980s. In which there was a drug epidemic, and the solution offered by the federal government was to just say no and to lock them up.
Mm-hmm.
We now see lots of folks talking about rehabilitation now that it's spread into the white community, and I've actually asked a judge about this not too long ago. What do you make of that? I mean, do you think that minority communities might be able to at least benefit from this shift in attitude from the white community?
We are hoping that, you know, that would be the situation. But a lot of the conversations that I'm hearing is that, why is it that in the 80s, it was like, lock them up, you know, the war on drugs was, focus was more retributive. But now we're seeing where it is like, we need to rehabilitate. But I think it would be good if we have that kind of focus, because it cannot be all about drugs is not, or use of drugs is not really that criminal. So it cannot be lock them up, throw away the key. We have to focus on how do we help them. So having, for example, treatment and having drug courts, I think that is the way to go.
I want to turn to our first writer, Anastasia. And I wanted to, first of all, play a bit of what she wrote. She's, just to remind people, she's 19 years old, from Salisbury, graduated actually from Bennett High School. So let's play her part of her piece, and then we'll come back.
Growing up, Mama and Daddy working 2-3 jobs apiece. My mama still struggling, but she made sure we had something to eat. While my bros was wild and fell victim to the streets, fighting all the time brought a lot of different beef. Yeah, I seen him with the heat, I act like I ain't peep. I closed my eyes tight and I just played sleep. About 5 years old when I saw the world was cold, but I became so bold it made me out of control. Promised myself that I'd never fold. I was going through a lot and hiding it. The wave of negativity, I was riding it. But I ain't speak about the trauma that weighed on my brain, which is the reason why, you know, I'm halfway insane. My childhood pain turned me to a troubled teen. I was on probation on the verge of being another statistic. My brothers dropped out and headed straight to prison. Deuced 8 years, and when he came home, ain't nobody give him a hand. So where are his resources when he's a free man? They tried to catch us using the trap and use prison to make us institutionalized, knowing that we're going to go back. They got us thinking that we're black, but we are so much more. But I ain't speak about the trauma that weighed on my brain, which is the reason why, you know, I'm halfway insane. My childhood pain turned me to a young queen. And God came with a new face. Me and time was running the race, baking something in the oven that was setting me straight. Turned my fears into something that would motivate. Learn to love thyself, eliminate self-hate. Just like that, you changed me. Changed my whole mindset, you rearranged me. There is nothing I wouldn't do for you. It's me and you, and mommy got you through whatever, so I'm hoping that we can get better.
So, Anastasia, was it difficult to write this?
No. No, I wrote it in like 2 hours, but I had to like chop it down because it was actually longer than that. But we had to make it fit into like a 2 or 3 minute video. Mm-hmm. So I just took pieces out of the original poem and brought it to the story project.
So one of the lines, and we cut it short for some aesthetic purposes. You say that I'm saying too much. They're going to kill a young queen. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is when you start telling the truth, and if you start bringing light to a lot of people, when I mean they, I mean... mm-hmm. Honestly, I mean, like, the government. Yes, you, like, some people think that I'm like a... conspiracy theorists or whatever. But I mean, it's the truth. A lot of people get killed for telling the truth, but it gets covered up, of course.
Mm-hmm. You know. So what did you want people to get from this piece in terms of understanding who you are and what your experience is?
I want people to get that, like, even if you're not, I mean, I was affected by the juvenile system, but I'm affected even more, being as though that my brother, they're black men, as they call it, they can't do what they actually want to because they fell victim to their circumstances because of things that they had to do. And they can't even get jobs and stuff like that because of their past. So how are they going to change? What do you want them to do if you're not hiring them for the simple fact that they've been to prison?
So, and you talk about at the very end, what we heard is that mommy got you through whatever, hoping we can get better. What do you mean by that?
I have a 2-year-old son. Okay. And ever since he came, I've just been a totally different person. And me and him, we're going to make it out.
How do you think that changed you? I mean, what was it like what you were before as opposed to what you are now with your child?
Well, like, before, I was, like, in a lot of drama and stuff and didn't really have too much of a care in the world. And I was actually on probation until I was 7 months pregnant. And when I found out that I was pregnant, like, everything changed. Like, I felt like I really had to fulfill a mission. And I did not want my son to grow up how my brothers had to.
What, was there a moment in that prison when you came to that realization? What was that like? Was there a...
It was like, honestly, it was like instantly when I seen my sonogram. But it really hit me hard the day that I had him. Like, they laid him on my chest and I cried for like 7 minutes straight. Like, I still have the video and everything. So, like, yeah, when I realized that I was pregnant and then when I had him in my arms.
Mm-hmm.
So
how do you see your life now unfolding? I mean, in terms of work and all the rest, all those things we got to, you know, run around and do.
What do you mean, how do I see my life unfolding?
I mean, how in terms of, like, you know, what are you doing in terms of, like, you know, whether it's work or whatever it is that you're doing and raise your son? And
well, I'm just trying to be the best that I can. I'm trying to work so that way I can support me and my son financially. And then I'm also trying to get more involved with the community. I know me and Jermichael were working on something right now, a little writer's club.
Mm-hmm.
But that's coming soon. And, like, yeah, I'm just trying to get more involved in the community because I want to see change, especially in my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, on the line, you talk about eliminating self-hate.
I guess you could say, well, yeah, you can say at one point that I did not love myself. Like, I didn't really, and if I kind of thought I did, but I really didn't understand what it meant to love yourself. And I eventually learned how to do that. Still working on it, though.
You're working on it? So what was it that you were hating about yourself then? I mean, what is it? Was it things you were just doing or what?
Yeah, my circumstances and the things that I was doing. I used to do a lot of things and I wouldn't think about it until afterwards. So I eventually learned to, like, you know, think about the things that I do. And when I started thinking about the things that I do, it changed my perspective on a lot of things. And it actually helped me change once again.
Dr. Jones, Walter, I'm going to turn to you for a moment. So what do you make of her? Is her story typical in any fashion or what?
It is typical because what we are hearing from her story is not just the way the system affected her. She talks about her brother being affected by the system. And she talks about, you know, having a child and, you know, trying to make sure that we don't have a cycle of, you know, Black youths getting into the system. So it's very important because a lot of time we look at the stories or we look at what they do in isolation, but we have to look at the bigger picture. And with respect to policies and programs, that is where we need to focus. We cannot just concentrate on the youth or on the person who is in front of the system, in front of the courts, who is coming in contact with the police. We have to look at the broader picture in order to be able to provide solutions and to help.
Because one of the things that strikes me as she was talking about is this idea of reaching, becoming more involved in the community is perhaps what she was before. Is that key to it may be a key to for everybody for that matter, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. It is key because, you know, again, even with our story, by telling our story, it is going to be out there. So it's not just for adults in the community. It's going to be for other juveniles or youths who are growing up. They're going to look at her story, they're going to hear her story, and they're going to realize that, you know, if she can rise above what she went through, then we can also do that. So it's really a teaching tool, like you said in the beginning.
I want to turn to Brooks Douglas. He's 28, raised here in Salisbury, also now a musician, amongst other things. Let's go ahead and hear what he did, and then we're going to come back.
I'm on Madison Street in Salisbury, Maryland, January 18th, 2008. It's me, my little cousin, and my cousin's husband, William, and we're watching TV, and William was drinking alcohol and smoking cigarettes, and there was a party in the duplex next door. You can even hear the walls vibrating. William went in the kitchen to get a cigarette, but I had smoked his last one. He got in my face and started pushing me. Now, I didn't like William because he was abusive and he beat his wife to a pulp. When he came at me, we started to fight. I blacked out and almost killed him. I'm 18 and I'm facing 40 years. I'm scared. I'm in a pod full of gangbangers who really killed people, and they were looking at me like fresh meat. I picked out the biggest guy I saw and picked a fight with him and lost, but I earned my respect. I sat in solitary confinement for 30 days for that fight. I prayed, and that cold, dark cell lit up. I've always struggled with my anger. I didn't fit in anywhere. I've always been the black sheep in the family. My mom, the aerospace engineer, my twin brother, the good twin, my little brother that everyone cares for. I've always been ugly and a nerd. They would push me into lockers and pick fights with me at school. I fought back. People eventually stopped messing with me, and I felt powerful. But my father died and my anger got worse. Nobody was there to teach me how to be a man. I had to teach myself. I know I'm not the only one dealing with something like this. Being kicked out of a nice suburban home at 18, being homeless, sleeping in parks. I would have my blanket, my trench coat, my gun, and my book bag for a pillow. When I got out, I tried going to church, but didn't like it. I struggled with using drugs, and then something happened. I found piano, and when I played, my anger was still there, but the pain went away. Then I found drums again, and when I play, I feel like I'm beating out my anger. I don't fight anymore. I walk away. I still get angry, but I have positive outlets now. I rap, sing, play piano, and drums. When I rap, I feel the angry fire fade away. I can have a conversation with whoever I'm upset with, and we can come to a conclusion.
So, Brooks, you talk about anger.
Yes, 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 yes.
Where do you think that came from? You talk about actually being a suburban home and as opposed to your siblings.
I'll tell you where it came from. I was 12 years old, right? And my mom and dad loved each other, right? So they started arguing because I was getting in trouble in school, right? I mean, I couldn't get to fit in, but I was doing good with my schoolwork. But people were just picking with me and laughing at me because I had scaly skin. I had eczema, right? And they called me Raccoon and Appalachian Mountains on my forehead. I was angry coming home, busting holes in the walls, costing $2,000 worth of damage because of what happened in school. And then my mom and dad started arguing because my dad didn't want to beat me, but my mom wanted to beat me. And she was like, well, you got to do something because you're his father and you're not doing anything as a father figure. So my mom was a disciplinarian. Are you catching up? Because I can slow down if you want me to. But I'm going to keep going because I got to let this go. Anyway, so that anger came from not being able to accept myself. I was seeking acceptance from other people. I didn't even know the concept of what love was. I can remember that my mom even told me when I was a little baby, I was defiant. She wanted me to drink from a sippy cup. I said, no, I'm going to sleep. I'm a baby, Mom. She even told me it got upset about it. You know what it is? It's a sin issue, y'all. And I'm keeping it up front with you. I'm not religious. I told you I went to church. I hated it. I hate legalism. I hate politics. I hate the government. The only thing I love is God and Jesus Christ himself, dog. That's why I wear the weather and I come the way I come, dog. And I don't care if the opinions that y'all talk about because I bring facts, y'all. Like, I get angry and we can talk it out, rap it out, sing it out, play it out. We can squabble it out, but I mean, bring the facts to the get-go, y'all. because I know that it was a sin problem. I couldn't love myself. I hated what I was doing and what I wanted to do. I just could not get it right. They even called me can't get right. Now I'm going to take a break.
Let me ask you this. So at this one moment in your story here, you said that you prayed.
Yes.
And that the cold, dark cell lit up. What was that about?
Oh, that's cold. Oh, ninjas from the hood know what that means. When I said that cold, dark cell lit up. Like when I prayed to God and I came out. I came in jail by myself. I walked out of jail with the community. When I say it lit up, I was surrounded by brothers that prayed over me. And they came from different hoods. I'm talking about Bloods, Crips, BGFs, Latin Kings. It don't matter. I'm a blood till I die. I'm covered with the blood of Christ. I ain't got no shame with who I ride for, 41 or nothing. You feel me? I ain't breaking law. I keep it real from the jump, yo. So I come back home, right? And this happened yesterday. I come back home, right? This part of the story. I come back to the west side, you know. My cousins ain't seen me for a minute. I'm acting up. I'm rapping. I'm stacking, repping my hood. Little dude come up, you know, misunderstanding. You know, they're like, man, what you talking about is unofficial. I said, how old are you, dog? He was like, probably like 22, 23. I said, I'm 28, homie. I said, I've been here longer than you have. When I was out here, you were still in middle school. And you try to do the same thing I'm doing. I said, you better respect a general when you see one. I'm not a gangbanger. I'm a soldier. I was bred up to be a soldier. And I got wounded. That's where the anger comes from. My dad and mom separated when I was 12. My dad died when I was 15. And then I had to teach myself how to be a man. And then that didn't work because I was a boy. How can a problem be the solution to the problem? So I had to rely to a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. See, it was a step-by-step process. You feel what I'm saying? Everybody, it's called the ultimate pain. We are all born, and this is what I strongly believe, right? We are all born with this innocence, this childlike faith. We believe in everything. Your mama come tell you Santa Claus coming when you were 3 years old. You remember you couldn't wait to stay up and hear Santa Claus running on the sleigh, not realizing that dad then took the ladder up the side of the house to walk across the sleigh and leave antler hooves because his grandpa is a reindeer hunter and keep the antlers on the roof. So he's, we go out there and say, Santa really came. But we got to a point of age where they got tired of it.
Let me ask you this. You talked about now when you mm-hmm. play music, mm-hmm. that the anger is still there, mm-hmm. but the pain is not. What do you mean by that?
Because I'm healed from my pain, and I'm fed up with people playing the victim.
Yeah.
I'm fed up with people. I mean, come on now. I'm black. I mean, you're white. You're Caucasian. Am I going to sit here for the rest of my life expecting reparations and demand you to give me what I think you owe me? Thank God that there's a solution for this disease called addiction. See, the first time we encountered it, we didn't know how to handle it. And unfortunately, it got into our community. But addiction has no discrimination of race, creed, sexual identity, or nothing. So when it hit the white community, black people want to be caught up in their feelings. Oh, they get to go to rehabs. Ninja, you the one off dope too. You need to go to rehab right along with that white brother over there and stop tripping.
Yeah.
I don't care about that. I mean, I'm glad because I be struggling out here too. Like, I'm going to rehab too. Hey, yo, what's up, white brother? What's up, black dude? What's up, Chinese dude? Yeah, we all in it to win it for real. Stop playing the victim. Wake up and get the children safe, yo. Because if we sleep too long, I'm mad about the people running up in Sandy High School shooting up kids. I'm ready to go to war for the children. Forget about addiction. Our kids are dying. That's why I'm angry.
Go ahead. We were speaking with Brooks Douglas. He's 28 years old, raised and born in Salisbury, and he's now a musician and a bit of a rapper, as we see. There you go.
41 or nothing, yo. 41 or nothing. This is a 410 thing, baby.
And Anastasia, who is 19 years old from Salisbury, graduated actually from Bennett High School. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to switch out, and we're going to have a couple more writers. So we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. You know, one of the things I love most about food is its power to bring people together, and that food is a gateway to understanding culture. So it's in that spirit that every week we bring you stories and conversations that look at the world food first. That's The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters from APM, American Public Media.
Sunday morning at 10 on WSCL 89.5 FM.
I'm Eric Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Sunday at noon on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
Hi, this is KT with Delmarva Groove. This is the only show where you can hear new and old music that radio either won't play, or maybe they've just forgotten about it altogether. You can catch us on our new time slot, which is every single Friday night at 9 p.m. And enjoy all the other music programming WSDL has to offer. So tune in and get turned on WSDL 90.7 Rhythm and News.
And welcome back. This is Don Rush. Welcome back to Delmarva Today. And we're talking about a project called Bars, Stories of the System, a Youth Perspective. And that's also produced with the help of the Phoenix Youth Project. In our studios this morning, we have Tim Stock. He's associate professor at Salisbury University, who's helped establish the philosophy department's community impact internship. Also, Dr. Nelsita Walter-Jones, assistant professor who teaches criminal justice at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, focuses on juvenile justice. Our two writers, who we'll talk to in a moment, Daquise Douglas, Georgia, is 16 years old from Princess Anne and attends Washington High School, and also Andrew Carter Bay. He is 19, originally from Philadelphia, and is also happens to be a rapper. Walter Jones, I want to ask you about something that we heard in the last hour, which was this idea that, at least I get the sense, is that, you know, we can't help, we can't be victims anymore. I mean, that's sort of that sense of, what about that? That idea that yes, the system may be oppressive and so on and so forth, but we have to do something ourselves.
Yes, that is the reality, because sometimes we tend to try to focus on, you know, like I said before, focus on the offender, and for them to see themselves as victims, it's not going to help at all. So they need to find a way. If nobody else is going to find a way, they have to find a way to, you know, rise out of that situation. And that is what we are hearing from these stories. We hear of, you know, some of them resorting to music, some of them because of their kids focusing on, you know, making sure that their reality is not their kids' reality. So if we are going to get the systems to help, and I'm not just talking about the justice system, the school system, the family, because they too have an impact on, you know, what is happening with youths in our society. So if we're going to get the systems to help, we have to make sure that we take the focus of just trying to punish these youths. They have to not see themselves as victims. They have to find a way to see how they can move out of that situation. And like I said before, stop the cycle. We see in these stories a lot of youths who suffer from traumatic experiences. We see teenage pregnancy, for example. Those issues, if we do not try to put a stop or put programs in place to help these kids, we are going to continue to have that cycle of violence. For example, this research is showing that youths who become violent, for example, is because they experience violence. Youths who sometimes are abused, they end up being abusers. So we cannot focus on victimization per se. We have to focus on how do we help to heal the community. And that is why punitive measures will not work. We have to go with rehabilitation. We have to go with restoration. And that means, yes, making them responsible, holding them responsible, but also bringing the community into the picture and making sure that they are seeing that it's not just what they did, but the community is a part of the problem also.
Tim Stock, what about this idea about that people tend to moralize? They said, you know, they look at other people and they say, you know, responsible for what happened to you, and, you know, you should have known better. And we walk around with a set of values which can be actually pretty punitive.
I think that that's absolutely true. I mean, it comes out in part of what Nelsita was just saying. If you recognize the fact that a lot of people who are victimizing other people are themselves initially victims, it becomes very difficult to sort of think, well, at what point is this person supposed to be morally responsible if they've known a certain type of behavior and then are repeating it? But I also think that, you know, the same point came out in what Brooks was saying in the last hour, where he was trying to say, how is the individual meant to be both the problem and the solution? So I would make a distinction between the system victimizing people, which maybe we don't want to talk about that, but we can still talk about the way that the system is either just or not fully just. And then if we're talking about introducing programs like drug courts, rehabilitation, alternatives, just opening up opportunities for creative expression, like you were saying, things like music, poetry, anything we can do to give people a place in their community and to feel as if their activities and their voices are important is actually a part of that broader sense of justice. So we don't necessarily have to think about all matters of justice being happening within the criminal justice system. I think we try to isolate justice in one system. Justice is about our whole community.
Well, it turned out to Quise Douglas, Georgia. She's 16 from Princess Anne, also attends Washington High School. And we're going to go ahead and play her piece, and we'll be right back.
Happy Mother's Day. Mom, your head's in the wall. My brother's in your belly as Dad watches you fall. I'm 4 now, on the bed playing with my sister. Now you're out the door, Dad, and one day you will miss her. No one told me that I will start to miss you both, fighting others to get the attention. This never really seemed to work. Turning to boys at 11 to find a love I wish I had. Didn't really fulfill my needs. It only made me mad. The anger put me into the juvenile system, and I couldn't find a way out. Then tax time came, and after months of not seeing you, Dad, you asked to put me on your taxes. Is that all I am? At 15, I'm pregnant. My baby needs my love now. But 2 weeks before I found out, a fight broke out. I was jumped by 4 girls. 2 days after, another one, then one more. But now I have to stop this craziness. I'm going to be a mother. That's all I could think about while in that doctor's office. My baby father tells me he wants nothing to do with the baby. So now I'm on my own, trying to become a real lady.
So let me ask you, Tequise, so when you were writing this, was this particularly difficult, or was what was that experience like in the recounting these emotions?
It was really like a mix, mm-hmm. because like talking about my daughter, it's difficult, but it was okay talking about my daughter then. But with my dad, I really didn't care about that because, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So was it difficult to write about this?
Now it is, yeah.
Now it is? Mm-hmm. Why is that? I mean, is it just the raw emotion? What do you think?
Emotion.
Yeah. And you said that you were angry.
Mm-hmm.
Did they come from your home life or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was that like? What was your home life like?
So, my dad wasn't there because he was abusive and he beat on my mom. So, my mom told him he had to go. So, I was raised without my dad. And then I thought it was my mom's fault, so I seek attention from my dad, and I was rebellious against my mom.
Mm-hmm. And so did you find a way out of that anger then, do you think?
No.
Are you still angry?
Not really, because when I had found out I was pregnant, I changed. Like, mm-hmm. Everything had to stop.
So what was that like when you found out that you were pregnant?
I was scared, but then I just said that it probably going to be the better for me.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So you're going to school now? Is that right?
I'm homeschooled.
Homeschooled? Okay. And how old is your child?
I lost my child.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that. What was that like? I mean,
it was scary, yeah. But it's also very, like, emotional because, like, I had a lot of hopes, and I didn't believe what the doctor said when they told me. And then when it came to that, I just, yeah.
Yeah. So how are you handling it?
I'm taking it day by day. Like, yeah. I try to push my mind away from it. Like, I dance and everything to forget about it.
Mm. So if what was it like? So you get relief then from dancing? From
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, what is it just that you leave everything behind? Or
when I dance, I just forget everything. Like, everything out of my mind is just gone. But then it just comes right back because I know, like, I have everything of my daughter still because she was stillborn, but I still have everything from her.
Mm-hmm. So you're gonna so you're homeschooling. So what do you want to be when you get your?
I want to well.
Or anything in particular? Or?
I really wanted to be a dancer.
Oh, okay.
But if I can't do that, I'm going to go to nursing school.
Go to nursing school? Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Walter Jones. So is this? What do you make of her story?
Well, when we talked about this before, we talked about. The struggles of growing up, and somebody else said it was the struggles of staying young. We see, you know, everything that is happening around her, the conflict in the home. And it is sad because when we look at the research out there, the family is identified as one of the factors that's associated with, you know, delinquency or with youth crimes. And that is really sad. So, you know, like I said before, we cannot just focus on the individual. We have to look at everything that is happening around the individual. Is she still hungry? She said no. What happened, you know, to cause her to stop feeling that way? She said her child. So growing up and, you know, having to experience certain things, it's weird sometimes how that can cause changes. And, of course, the theorists would say, things happen in life to cause youths to stop committing offenses or to stop getting into trouble with the law. But when we look at some of the things that really force them into these situations, is it really what we want our youths to experience or not? Because, you know, our experience, I wouldn't want that for anybody else, any other youth. So her being able to, you know, put that out there and come and tell that story, you know, I'm really impressed with her.
Let me ask you this delicate question, I guess, but in both the stories we've seen, the women, that having a child focused the mind, that was a dividing line between their past and their present, and yet they're so young. I mean, so one question is, what is that kind of life going to be like later on? Because that being a parent's a tough thing.
It is a tough thing. And teenage pregnancy is, you know, like I said, it's one of the things that, according to the research out there, this is one of the things that is causing our youths to maybe get in trouble with the law. But it doesn't start there, of course. It starts with other things. For example, some kids tend to resist authority. I'm not saying that's what she was doing, but she talked about the conflict with the discipline in her home, with her mom and her dad. We see a lot of that. And when we have that kind of situation in the home, then we see sometimes when kids, they go into other directions. They try to look for the love and the attention and the things that they should have in the home, they try to seek it elsewhere. And that is what caused them sometimes to stray away, you know, and get into trouble. And for that to be, you know, the deciding factor that, oh, I'm not going to do this anymore, is not what we would want, but it's a reality. Kids sometimes are forced to grow up based on things that happen in their lives.
And Tequise, by the way, I'm sorry about your loss. Mm-hmm. What is to Andrew Carter Bay? He originally comes from Philadelphia. He's 19 and is a rapper. And why don't we go ahead and hear a little bit of that?
Sometimes I be so high, I don't know my left from my right. And every time shit go left, I just write.
I always wanted to be more. I always knew I could be more than what society set in stone for me, but emotions and misconceptions of things have me bet. On top of the fact that you have police, someone who's supposed to be there to help, discriminate because a kid has black skin. or curly hair and tats, teachers and coaches. I had both call me dumb for what I wanted to do. Music is my outlet for a lot of things. It's something I rely on heavily. Music never called me dumb, but teachers and coaches did. And it pushed thoughts in my head that made me drop out of school. Well, that and a few other events, like my mother just leaving during my junior year, right before the most important school year of my life, when I needed her most. She was gone. Left me with my stepdad in a big house that we couldn't even afford. Bills piled up. I couldn't afford clothes. Barely could afford to eat. I wasn't going to sit and watch and suffer even more than I already was. So, started selling drugs. One night, I was on my way to bust a track on my bike, and I seen lights flash. I didn't stop. I had 4 bags of crack, and I tried to dump it down the drain. I missed. Thank God they didn't see me, but once they caught up to me to warn me just about my lights, they stumbled upon those bags and charged me. And that's how I landed in the system. That's not me. I may spit crack, but I'll never sell it again. That's exactly what adds to the stereotypes and misunderstandings they have of us.
Help me understand, yeah, yeah. Pop it first, smoking loud. Lately I've been stressing, trying to make my mama proud.
So, Andrew, when you were writing this, what was going through your thoughts in terms of what you were trying to tell people about yourself?
About myself?
About yourself and your experience.
I just wanted to, because I'm pretty sure, like, you got dudes around the community who went through the same thing or something similar. I just wanted to let them know, like, give them a whole new perspective, like, to look within yourself instead of always looking at the opposite side, like, the law enforcement. Like, they definitely, the law enforcement, they definitely, I noticed, like, they profile, like, they definitely, what's the word I'm looking for?
They target you, or
yeah, they definitely target like a certain group of individuals. But at the same time, you got to look within yourself, like the things that you do wrong. Like, not always. I'm not gonna say correct. Like, don't correct yourself, but adapt. Because even though you may not be in the wrong, you just got to adapt to the situation. You got to adapt to. You got to understand where you are. So, really. Change yourself, change what you do. Cause like, I just always looked at it as, yo, I'm the victim. Like she said, don't look at yourself as the victim. And the things that you do, like, even though they may be profiling you, I was still had the crack though. I still had the drugs. I still tried to dump it down the drain. And even though that may not even had came out, I could have got away with that, but I still did it. So be conscious of yourself. Like, I say God. Like, I say it's God. God know what you did. You know what you did. So keep it honest with yourself.
You mentioned it, and you have a line about teachers and coaches. I've had both of them call me dumb for what I wanted to do. You said music is your outlet. And you said the music never called me dumb, but teachers and coaches did. What kind of impact does that have on you had to be going through that. Yeah, I mean,
I just wanted to, I'm gonna tell a little story about sure. That. You know, I had a football coach. I'm not gonna say any names or anything mm-hmm. like that, but I had a football coach who he pulled me to the side during my senior year, during my senior season. And he asked me, really, like, what do you wanna do? Because the year before, I got kicked out of school, my 11th grade year, and I was sent to alternative school. So, like, after that, like, he didn't lose faith in me, like, not necessarily on the field. He lost faith in me in the classroom. He lost faith in me as a student. So, I had, it was like the relationship wasn't there anymore. Like, we had a strong relationship at first, but the relationship is gone now. So, he asked me, he's like, yo, what do you really want to do? And I'm like, well, I want to be a rapper. I told him, like, music, like, that's where my passion is at. And he's like, basically was like, no, I don't see you doing that. I don't think you're going to make it that far. And, you know, I heard your music, you know. And he said stuff to me like, yo, yeah, I've been called stupid many a times for the choices that I made by him and, you know, teachers in the classroom. You know, I'm not one that's going to lie about that. You go, it's a lot of artists out here who lies about sure. stuff like that. But I really experienced that. So it's like, I want to bring light to, you know, the outlets too, because you can have football coaches. That's somebody who's supposed to be in the community to make it better. That's somebody who's supposed to help a kid go further. But instead of bringing you up and saying, yo, you can do it. Just put your heart into it. They put you down. And like, one thing I just want to say, you know, people ask me, you know, what's your backup plan? Like, what you think you're going to do, man? Like, God don't have no backup plan, right? God don't have a backup plan, so I don't think I need one. I just think I need to put my focus into one thing and make it happen.
So what do you, in terms of this idea about misunderstandings and stereotypes, you talk about that. And then and out of it, and we heard just a moment ago, where that you wanted help me understand. What do you mean by that?
No, it's a lot of things that I don't understand. Like, what's, like, this? A lot of things going on in the world right now that I don't understand why it's going on, when answers for the problem are in plain sight. You know, I just need help. Like,
yeah.
I need help to know why law enforcement is going around killing people. I need help to understand why I can't have tattoos and get a job, because I'll be looked at as a gangbanger. But you got European men or Caucasian men who have corporate jobs and have tattoos. I know some. They have tattoos. They look like me. They got symbols on their hands and everything else, just like me, but I can't get a job because of that, or I'm being racially profiled because of that.
Wait, by the way, in terms of law enforcement, so what is your experience like with law enforcement? I mean, if you get pulled over, and I mean...
I could tell you something that happened to me two sure. nights ago.
Sure, go ahead.
Two nights ago, I work at Walmart, and I was on my break, and I was standing outside with a friend while he smoked a cigarette, and law enforcement came around the corner on the back of the store, and I didn't have my uniform on. I took my vest off. Mm-hmm. So he's like, comes out, put the lights out, pulls the gun out. First thing he do, pull a gun out, put it in my face and say, put your hands up. He said, if you move, I'll effing shoot you. And I'm just like, I asked him why, like, and he's just like, what did he say? He said, because I don't know who you are. And it just, I feel like it's really important that we as youth and people really should learn their rights. Like, really learn what you have the right to do, because he's saying that he don't know who I am. That's vice versa. I don't know who you are. You didn't give me three forms of identification. You just pulled a gun out and put it in my face and said, you'll shoot me. And I really believed him. Like, he looked me in my eyes and said, if you move, I'm gonna kill you. And like going through that, like, I know how to deal with it mentally, but not everybody does. So other kids go through things like that. I heard about stories about kids getting slammed, kids going through getting beat up, searches and stuff, just because of what they look like, how they walk, stuff like that. And I just want to bring the light to that, but also want the kids to have a different perspective. Like I said, adapt to your situation and correct yourself if you're in the wrong.
What do you make of the idea that for certainly the white community, that's not an experience they've ever had? I mean, if I get pulled over, I've been pulled over before. They come up, they do their thing, and you chat or whatever it is, and
right.
they might get you out of the car for something, but
right.
there aren't any weapons.
First, before, I just want to say, you know, there's only, in my perspective, there's only one race, the human race. And, but not everybody sees it that way on each side, so-called black, so-called white. I just want to say, we should always look to be more like the city. Always look to be more as one.
So, Tim Stock, when you hear that, what goes through your mind? I mean, this divide that it clearly exists. I mean, it's not just law enforcement, but
I don't think he can say it any more clearly than
Andrew already said, which is two people looking across a gun at each other and saying they don't know who they are. They don't know who the other person is, right? I mean, that's it right there. Do we know who we are as a community? I mean, can one of the things that's so bold about this project and that I hope starts a conversation is, you know, if we can't even trust each other to have a conversation at the back of Walmart, how are we going to have a conversation about the things that are really difficult? How are we going to talk about addiction? How are we going to talk about homelessness? How are we going to talk about the things that are hard? And I am completely blown away by the storytellers in this project because they've taken the approach that if I share something where I'm vulnerable, maybe it can start a conversation and people can get to know me. But there's another side of that as well, right? I mean, trust goes two ways. So I don't have much more reaction than just we need to keep talking about it and we need to keep listening to these stories. And I applaud the courage of the storytellers for sharing what they have.
Mm-hmm. Walter Jones, I mean, we've gone through actually now a few years in talking about police shootings of mm-hmm. black people. We now all have it on video, which probably makes a big difference because it didn't just start happening yesterday. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that divide? That there are going to be lots of white people who, that's not their experience. And if you don't experience something in some fashion or another, it's invisible.
Just by listening to Andrew's story, we see both sides, because he talks about what the theorists would call the primary deviation. He, you know, talks about admitting to what he did, and then we have society's reaction. So the way society reacts sometimes can put people in a box. That is when we start getting the labeling. So coming up on somebody who is black, we talk about this. Even yesterday, we were discussing this. We had Criminal Justice Week, and we had law enforcement agencies there. And we were talking about it. Why is it that coming up on a black person, there is a certain kind of fear? And why is it that they would want to react a different way? Sometimes it has a lot to do with attitudes. You know, he talks about owning what he did. It's not just attitude on one side. It's a law enforcement officer. He may have had an experience in the past where he came up on somebody and it didn't go off too well. So he's thinking, I need to protect myself. It could be the attitude of the youth or the juvenile. Maybe sometimes it's not their own experience, but a vicarious experience. So they had an experience, or they learned of an experience with an office that wasn't really good. So they decide, you know, I am not going to take this. So sometimes they don't know the law. They don't know how they're supposed to behave. But sometimes they want to play street lawyers. So based on their experience in the past or based on others' experience, they sometimes tend to react. But the reality is that, you know, that kind of communication, that kind of relationship, it has to change. There has to be a better understanding of how to deal with each other when it comes to cops dealing with minority youths.
We've been speaking with Dr. Nelsita Walter Jones, assistant professor who teaches criminal justice at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, focuses on juvenile justice. Also, Tim Stock, associate professor at Salisbury University, who's helped establish the philosophy department's community impact internship. Also, Amber Green with the Phoenix Youth Project, and our writers, Anastasia, who 19 years old from Salisbury, graduate of Bennett High School, Brooks Douglas. He's 28, born and raised here in Salisbury, and is now a musician. Taquise Douglas, Georgia, is 16, from Princess Anne, attends Washington High School, and Andrew Carter Bay, 19, originally from Philadelphia, now a rapper. And we appreciate you all participating in this.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.